In this bonus episode of Fictional Hangover, we discuss pavlovas, wafting, LGBTQ plus representation, and signed copies of books with Miss Gail Carriger.
Hey everybody, so welcome to Fictional Hangover, a podcast about young adult and new adult books, series and authors that is full of spoilers. I'm Claire.
And I'm Amanda. Please enjoy this interview with Miss Gail. Because we did. Oh my god! So thanks for joining us again.
Oh!
How many times is this? Like 12, 14?
Always. All of them. Always my pleasure. I love talking to you guys.
Which is good because we like to get you back again and again and again and again. And
yay!
Again and again and again forever.
Not that we're mildly obsessed.
Good.
It's not mild. It's
still
the
healthy.
Thing.
It's still healthy.
I don't know about that. How have you been?
Oh, okay. You know, trucking along. Better than a lot of people, I guess, is how I would put it right now. It helps to be an introvert in times like this. I was like, oh, who knew being an introvert would be a survival tactic in 2020? There you go.
Yeah, I've not really been bothered that much by not leaving the house.
I am a little concerned, actually, by how sanguine I am about the whole thing. I was like, I don't even really miss hugging my friends or anything like that. I was like, am I a cold fish? I might be a cold fish.
I
don't even have any friends in real life, so it's fine. All of my friends,
all virtual anyway.
Well, yes, I visit my physical friends. I see like once every 6 months, like we meet for Christmas and birthdays because our birthdays are all clumped together over the summer. So it just happens to be every 6 months we see each other. But now they've turned into virtual friends because we have something virtual every Wednesday night, and it's like, oh, I actually talk to you more now than.
You used to, yeah. I had that happen for a while there. I had like too many people wanting to like do meetings and stuff like that, and I was like, some of you I haven't seen in like a decade, and that's fine. I'm like, we don't need to, like, why are you crowding my schedule with virtual get-togethers? Like, I don't need to see you.
No, we have 2 hours of Mario Kart on a Wednesday night on the Switch. Oh. Where my ass is handed to me every week.
Yeah, that's me with any video game. I profoundly suck at all video games, and so get no enjoyment from them at all. Yeah, I don't like to do anything I'm not good at, so I'm just like.
But you did see, Miss Gail, my dandelion, who is a dandy on his own, call me rutabaga on his own.
That is amazing. I don't know what happened there, but that's pretty impressive. I was pretty excited about that.
I like to think there's a Japanese programmer out there who was the massive Parasolverse fan.
It's possible the Prudence books are translated into Japanese, so.
Yes, I was trying to find alternate language books last night, and I'm like, no, I can't find any. Amazon has let me down.
They should, if you're talking about mine, they show up sometimes, but you know, it's third party sellers and I have to get a hold of. I mean, I haven't, about maybe a third of my foreign languages, I don't have a physical copy. I don't know what those books look like.
I would adore, I wish this for a lot of different book covers because my walls would be covered, that the alternate language when the sketches, so like the Russian translation, that you could actually get them in print version on the wall, they would be absolutely
I would
delicious.
Do it, but like I don't have the copyright, so I can't.
Exactly,
like,
that's why
posters.
It's absolutely annoying. It's like, come on, people.
I keep saying this to my I actually have said this to my publisher, especially for Solas, which like won all of these awards and stuff. I was like, why don't you guys just offer posters? Like, it's not like you don't have printing facilities. Like, you have the mechanism in place, and it would be just an additional source of income. Anybody who wanted posters of your book covers could get them, but no.
Exactly.
Like movie posters, you know, you think people would want them, but.
Plus one.
I would. My entire house would be covered.
Wouldn't it be cool? Like, there are some beautiful, like, amazing posters out there. I mean, part of the problem is, like, if it's a sourced artwork, you know, like when they hire, you know, like John Boccaccio, somebody to do a cover, then the rights to the poster version aren't owned by the publisher, just the cup, just, you know, for like you had, so it's a whole different like contract sell posters. Mm. And sometimes with those, you can go find the artist and they're selling the poster. And so you can get a print that way. But my stuff, the photo manipulation stuff, they don't seem to do anything with. And they own the rights to those. So.
Yeah, I think it's more the artistic ones, isn't it? Yeah. Like the drawn ones are the ones I'm always after because somebody's taking time. It feels like a lot more effort has gone involved in thought and care in those than necessary taking the photograph. Is. But you know, the photograph like ones are just as stunning.
Yeah, but the drawn ones are like way more expensive.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. See, sell them as prints, make more money, and then you're offsetting the cost of them.
Exactly.
Come on, publishers. Come on. Anywho.
Yeah.
That's my grievance, Ed.
Everyone would buy them, though. It would be fantastic. It's coming. Claire,
It's time. It is so time. It's time.
It's time for Would You Rather, and this time is so special because our favorite of most favorite authors is back. Miss Gail is with us again.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Hello, hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
There's one author that needs no introduction on this podcast.
None at all. Because how many episodes do we talk about her? At least all of them. In some passing form or another.
I mean, like I've said on many occasions, I'm not at stalker level yet, but you know, I'm not in America. So
the sea that separates us is all that keeps me safe. Is that what you're trying to say?
Basically. I would be nice about it though. Too. I would bring tea and biscuits. I wouldn't just stalk you empty-handed. There would be offerings made.
That's the important part.
Exactly. What's the point of traveling all that time? That's bringing twinings. I mean, come on.
True. I'm drinking it right now.
Same.
Oh my gosh. We should play Would You Rather. I think we should play Would You Rather. Claire, what's our first question?
The question we asked on social media and as well, we posted onto the Parasol Protector Squee group. And if you are a fan of Miss Gale's, go on there now. Is Would You Rather dress as a yellow butterfly or a moth? And this was an homage to Mrs. Bagley, who is the housekeeper to Bertie and just simply wonderful in every single way. And I need more of her. That is a fact. So on Facebook, 54% said butterfly and 46% said moth. On Instagram, 44% said butterfly and 56% said moth. And on Twitter, it was a straight up 50-50.
Ooh.
I'm very surprised. There was a lot of anti-yellow in the comments.
There was. They were all anti-yellow.
Yeah, that's me. I don't like yellow. I have tried to make my peace with yellow as something to wear over the years and never managed to do it. So it is like one of the few like block categories of colors that I went with. I have a lot of other colors that I'm not particularly into, like olive green, but I like green, right? And yellow, I'm pretty much the whole category. Like I have tried butter yellows and soft yellows and bright yellows, and no, it does not. Like I have a real yellow skin tone, like, you know, and it just makes me, yellow makes me look jaundiced, doesn't matter what, whether it's warm or cool or whatever. So so I went with moth for this one.
I'm trying to think if I have anything yellow in my wardrobe, and I
have lots of yellow.
Do not. You have a complexion that would suit yellow, though.
Yeah, I think I'm more blue on the inside than I am yellow. Like my tone.
I have
blue,
yellow flowers on the top I'm wearing, and yellow honeybees. But no, I don't want anything yellow. See, but I can't go moth because I have a trauma about moths.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
What is your moth trauma,
which to this day is still I was brushing my teeth, and you know, sometimes you get like that build up of toothpaste, like foamy stuff at the corner of your mouth. A moth flew into the bathroom and landed on the side of my mouth as I was brushing my teeth, and it freaked me out. I had to stop. I had to clean, and I basically scrubbed my face so much it was red raw. And ever since then, and we're talking like 20 plus years of trauma from this one single moth. Even last night in bed and I'm just reading, and a moth came in through the open window, and I'm looking at her going, you're gonna die, you have to die. I'm sorry, all wildlife enthusiasts, so you know, people who care for wildlife, but if a moth comes near me, I squish it into the weird ass powder it turns into. I hate moths, so as much as yellow doesn't suit my complexion, I will suffer it not to be a moth. And those huge giant ones in Australia.
Oh, I think they're amazing. I don't have any critter or anything, so I don't mind butterflies or moths. So it's all based on color for me.
Yeah.
I think I would be a moth just because there are more options of color. Like, this is a very specific yellow butterfly. Mm. But I would like to be in any other colors. So I don't want to be limited. I don't want to be forced to be yellow.
I'm just happy to have a cape, if I'm honest. Capes are underrated.
It is fun to waft. Yeah. I have a couple of dresses with sort of capes or flowy, you know, attachments or whatever. And like, yeah. I'm always wafting. You just, once you're trailing something, yeah, you're exactly. You're like, now I am tempted to just sort of flourish as I walk everywhere.
Yeah, and you kind of like do this kind of, you like, have to value, kind of, whew, where you just kind of click your feet up. You're like, oh, I'm prancing around everywhere. And everybody gives you funny looks. I don't care. I'm wafting and I'm fabulous.
I'm wafting here. Yeah, this weekend actually was supposed to be Denver Comic Con. And I was really excited to go because I've never been to an event that was also a 4th of July weekend event. And I had all of these outfits that were like superhero but me planned, and most of them involved capes of some kind that I was going to be wearing. And that is mostly why I'm sad it's not happening.
Oh, no.
My outfits were so good. Hopefully I'll have an opportunity to wear them all again someday.
You should just wear them and take pictures.
You will need to catwalk them. Yeah.
Yeah, too much effort.
I need an event, goddammit.
Yeah, I know. I have to have a reason.
Not me. I'll just live every day in costume and it's fine.
You'd live every day in 6 costumes if given the opportunity.
I love wearing costumes, probably too much, but that's okay.
I know, you are such an addict.
Thank you for me being in every single cosplay thing that you have on Pinterest too. I noticed that. I was like, I'm there.
It's too much. Every time
if you make it pinnable, I'll pin it. Like, that's just your sort of rule. I was like, well, you didn't hide the image, so like it gets pinned.
I don't think you'll ever. No,
I've got another good one for this week too, I think.
I've seen it already. Twice. It's excellent. I'm looking forward to next week's as well.
Next week's is gonna be fun. But we can't spoil it.
Oh, there's so many choices from Defy and Defend as well.
I know, it's so good. Okay.
Next question.
Would you rather be called Honeybee or Sparkles?
I think Honeybee. Mostly because Sparkles is just not really my personality at all. I don't think, even if I'm wearing like gold, a gold dress or a silver dress or something, I don't think anyone's ever attempted to call me Sparkles or Spark. I don't know. My personality would never be defined as sparkling in any way. So it just doesn't suit. So it has to be Honeybee by default, although I'm not particularly sweet either. But yeah. So Honeybee.
Even though you have an aversion to yellow?
Even though I have an aversion.
I feel like they're tied together.
But they are, like, I am kind of like, you know, like roly-poly busy the way a bee is. You know, I'm always like going from one thing to another thing, collecting this thing and like taking back home and, you know, organizing it and stuff like that. So that's kind of just more like it's, and I am sort of noisy.
You're going to say Ash Kutty the Honey Dance as well.
Maybe. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Like food does make me dance. So like, I get very excited, including in restaurants, to my partner's charm and embarrassment when, like, the food comes to the table. I'm always like, yeah, it's so exciting. Look at how cool it is. Like, look at the food.
I get excited by aeroplane food. It's just, the whole experience is delightful.
Yeah. I mean, anytime somebody, like, another person brings me food, it is reason to embrace life as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. Added to the fact you don't have to do the washing and cleaning up afterwards. Just, oh, I miss those days.
Where are you, a honeybee or sparkles?
Honeybee, because there's nothing sparkly about my personality. People tell me I'm positive and enthusiastic. I don't believe them. I think I'm more, you know, cynical and abrasive, but that might just be me. So I like the idea of honeybee because I could sting you.
I'm going to go with sparkles because I feel like I am sparkly, even if it's for pretend. I think I can pretend sparkle very well. So I'm going to be sparkles.
Nice. Okay, next question. Would you rather solely communicate through homemade Valentine cards or strategically applied eyelash fluttering?
I love this question.
Valentine's cards, definitely. Because, yeah, because it's written, so, and crafty and stuff. I used to homemade Valentine's cards all the time. It's like, I don't know, but I like sort of two-dimensional art forms that are also something that you can give to other people. Yeah, I like useful art. It's a weird quirk, I guess. There's a reason I was a potter for years, and that's because I like to give pottery because, like, it's a thing that you can also use, right? And so that makes me, it's also why I like to, you know, cook and bake and stuff, because, like, it's like an art form, and I always decorate things really prettily because I like pretty things. so definitely the Valentine's cards.
I'm big on paper crafts and making. I make my husband a Valentine's card every year, and I've done it since 2009, I think. And they're all, like, they all have a theme. I made a Castlevania card a few years ago. I did Star Wars this year. I have a Gandalf stopping the Balrog. I have too many, but they're pretty great. And he keeps them on display all year until the next one comes.
That's cool.
They are good. You sent me pictures and they are epic. Like, there's a lot of effort goes into those ones. You know, I'm with you.
I like making Valentine cards. Just going to make them.
Yeah, I like crafting. I'm like a baker more. Like, I will give gifts of cake and biscuits. I love baking. I adore it. I made a pavlova the other day. It was just...
I'm so jealous. Do you have a signature bake
that,
like, you're kind of known for?
No, not particularly. Like, if you ask my son, he'll say my meatballs. But then he also says I do the best egg fried rice. Like, but then he adores... when I make biscuits, like, I don't know. I used to have a signature bake, which was Halloween biscuits, and it would take hours. It would break my back. I would make gingerbread men and then put the mummy wrappings around them and make them 3D.
Wow.
And yeah. And vampire biscuits with the jam inside, and so it looked like the blood. Coming out.
Yeah.
I haven't done those in quite some time, because it is a lot of time to do them. It takes me a couple of days to do them. But I tend to make the birthday cakes every year. Like, I made a volcano dinosaur cake with, like, the chocolate, white chocolate ganache I dyed green, poured it over, and then a Malteser volcano with the ganache coming out. So it looked like it was pouring. They are not, like, sculpturally, they will never go on Great British Bake Off. They will never be there. They look homemade in the highest definition of homemade, but they always taste nice. I don't make a bad bake.
That's important.
That's very important.
That is important.
And I've recently gotten into pavlovas, making my own meringues. The Nigella Lawson one is my favorite because it's the gooey on the inside.
That I like the key to a pavlova is it has to have, the meringue has to cover all three textures. So it has to be soft and fluffy and gooey and crispy on the edges. Like, That's why you do a pavlova, a big pavlova, and not little individual ones, right? Yeah. And I am known for this being my favorite dessert, and yet I live in Northern California where you cannot get pavlovas. It's just not a thing here. Like, you just can't. They're just not. They don't really exist. I mean, you can occasionally find them in a restaurant or something. And so my partner was like, I am going to make you one for your birthday. Last year, I think this was. And so they went to all this effort to, like, find these Mary Berry's recipe, and did not, like, change proportions at all. And the resulting pavlova was about the size of our stovetop.
Yes.
It was like a large-sized pizza. And yes. It was huge. That was the meringue size. You know, like the whole pavlova.
Yes.
And I had to eat the whole thing.
Oh, a never last slog in my house, ever. I have to use... my son's going to have it, he doesn't like cream, so I have to use yogurt. He loves yogurt, so instead of cream, and because the yogurt's like a wetter, it goes into the pavlova soon, so you have to eat it quicker. But if it's cream, it lasts a few days. But we went fruit picking at a local farm and just had this great big pile of fresh fruit, and I needed to do something with it, so I decided to make the pavlova. If the one I eat, I have to make half the recipe, and it still turns out the size
enormous. Yeah, that's what
it
like
is massive.
I was gonna get another one this year, and I was basically like, look, there really is only the two of us, and I have to eat most of this thing, so can you make half? But we ended up not
I
bothering
made half,
I was like, that's just
still
so
huge.
Much sugar. It's so sweet and it's so much sugar.
I did half last. I'd never made one until last year, and I had two different recipes. One of them may have been Mary Berry, the other one was Nigella Lawson. I tried them both, and the Nigella was much fluffy, like marshmallowy kind of texture on the inside. And I only did half, thinking, okay, I'll do a full one for Christmas Day when my in-laws come round. And I still just maintained and did half because it's just so big. My oven is not big enough. It's not just that you need an industrial size oven for this thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's absolutely wicked big. But yes, I have promised if I ever meet physically Amanda, I will make her a pavlova because she'd never heard of
good.
Them.
Good. They're so good. So I did grow up with them because they're weirdly popular in the corner of Devon, which is near Exeter, that I spent like my childhood with my grandparents on, you know, in summer times and stuff.
Yeah.
And specifically there in Devon, it tends to be a raspberry pavlova.
Yeah.
At least in the parts that I was. And it tends to be... with clotted cream because you're in Devonshire, right? And that is like the pavlova that I think of as my childhood thing. And oh my God, they're so good.
You can get this banoffee one from a local shop, and oh my gosh.
No.
But they are small. They're just like individual pavlovas, but they're still huge, where you could happily share them. And it's a banoffee, and it's like as tall as... It's just easily. Oh gosh,
I have a pavlova wish list, and on that wish list is a passion fruit laced pavlova, which I know you can probably get down under, and someday I will eat this thing because passion fruit is my favorite fruit and pavlova is my favorite dessert. And so someday before I die, I will find and eat. That's it. That's my life goal. Yeah, probably.
We need to cover a different life goal. A different Parasolver series, and I will make for the cover picture a passion fruit pavlova. I will eat it afterwards, but it will be pictured.
We got sidetracked. Where this would you rather got into food, and then
we
all
did.
Bets are
right,
it's food.
Yes.
It's food.
Would you rather kill off a tyrannical mastermind, overthrow a secret society, or stop a pudding war?
It depends, I suppose. Yeah, this is serious. It depends on the ramifications of a pudding war, because if a pudding war results in like some sort of lack of pudding or custard or egg, then that is a serious business that must be ended as quickly as possible.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, those things are sacred and should get, you know, supply lines must not be affected. So under the theory that a pudding war involves some sort of like damage to trade in terms of custard distribution, then I'm probably going to go with the pudding war.
I think given the conversation about pavlova, I'm all over with you there. We cannot stop the cream supply.
No.
I want to stop a tyrannical mastermind.
Yeah, the thing is, a mastermind is, you know, like dangerous and overt. And the secret society, like, you know, one of the tenets of my universe is that like true power is in people who are manipulating in the background. And so like if a secret society is like morally or ethically bankrupt and is against your like general tactics to thrive, then probably the secret society is the greatest risk.
I kind of like the idea of the secret society being overthrown and nobody would know about it either.
Exactly.
And it's kind of like
yeah, exactly.
I just delight in it.
But see, then I also want to be a part of the secret society.
But it's a very,
so could I take it down from the inside?
You could be part of a secret society that overthrows the tyrannical secret society.
It's a very triumvirate thing, right? Because like the Pudding War, so we have Pudding War, secret society, and mastermind. So like Alexia is going after a mastermind, Sophronia is going after a secret society, and Prudence is stopping a Pudding War. It's like kind of like the three different series is in one question, right? Like, so like whose personality do you tend to associate with the most if you're like going up against these things? Because it's going to require a different kind of personality to, like, if you need to be brash and forward and out there and like crazy and take risks and stop this Pudding War, then like that's your Prudence, right? If you need to be like practical and like strategic in your approach, and then you know that's Alexia, and it's good. And if you need to be secretive, then it's going to be Sophronia. So
what if it was a tyrannical mastermind of a secret society trying to stop pudding trade?
Well, it would take all three of them, wouldn't it?
The ultimate of evils.
Exactly.
Anywho. You. Next question.
What if it was like, wait, what if it was like a sexy pudding fight? And everyone is like,
you had to go there with the chocolate mousse pudding being thrown around. And
yeah.
Well, suddenly we're in we jumped ship to the San Andreas universe.
Yeah. Let's visit San Andreas for a while.
And or
now we're talking to GL characters.
Yeah, I've got a reality TV show going on in the background that is like, I don't know.
I don't think I would stop that pudding war.
Merman pudding wrestling or something like that.
Now on pay-per-view.
Exactly.
I'm more likely to try and market it than I am to stop it.
Yeah. I would be in the front row, like, trying to get
you
in
could be
it.
The girl who, like, oh, the big, you know, the person who goes around.
Oh, I can hold up the cards.
Yeah, round one, round two. Now it's mint chocolate. Mm,
okay.
Now we have added caramel.
Yes.
This, and there'll be a custard round.
But what do I wear while I'm doing that?
An apron. It's pudding. You need, you know, Cannell's leather apron.
I would wear Cannell's leather apron. I would wear the hell out of Cannell's leather apron.
No, you would wear the hell out of Cannell in the leather apron.
This is probably. Yes. Okay, now that
thank you
that has happened, what's our last question?
Would you rather go goth with all the black velvet, poetry and melancholy, or run around in a nightdress through the woods being overly dramatic and lovesick? I love this question.
Running around through the woods in a nightdress. We've already discussed wafting already, so like I feel like I have a leg up in the wafting arena. And I already have future plans, which I have, you know, talked about on multiple occasions, to become a permanent resident of cruise ships and wear white trailing dresses and waft about and never talk to anybody or say anything, just like leave my room at, say, midnight and waft around the decks in a vintage, you know, huge straw hat and white trailing dress, and then just like, go back to my room so people will just constantly be like, who is that woman who lives in 406A? That's my retirement plan. So clearly wafting is in my future.
Wafting.
Yes, that's a great plan. I like it.
I've just got these images suddenly just turning up at the shovel board, do one little push of the thing and then walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they have those midnight buffets on cruise ships, don't they? And you just walk past and, you know, eye them up and then just walk away. And everybody's like, is the cruise ship haunted?
Yeah, exactly. Or you show up and you only ever eat like one thing.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's like the midnight chocolate one. Ship. Just one truffle.
Yeah. Just one and then walk away.
Yes. Of course, you will have a plate sent to the room.
Of course, yes. But only be seen ever to like eat one thing, or maybe just not even eat, like maybe just take a bit of the decoration off the buffet. Just be like, that bird of paradise flower is mine. Just walk away.
Oh no, you see, I went on a cruise when I was 18 and I feel like I've missed a trick here. I didn't waft at all.
Sad.
You've clearly missed out. We should all go on a cruise together and
see. The problem is I do get seasickness. Like, I have to just sit on deck. So as long as I've got an open window during the day and I can emerge on a night, I'll be fine. I need the food.
What if you're constantly wafting? Do you think would you get used to it? Because you're already like rocking and wafting. Would it balance out?
No, I did try. I spent my entire time above deck because it's the only way to negate the sick feeling, which was hilarious because the entire time beforehand, me and my brother were like, oh, we'll just sit at the dining room table and just back and forth and make other people sick. And I was the one who succumbed to, it wasn't like massive, but if it was a queasiness, I didn't particularly appreciate. It was a good trip though. I went to Pompeii and everything. It was great.
I've never been on a cruise. I mean, I've done a lot of boat stuff, but you know, like little cruises around cities or, you know, up and down rivers and that sort of thing. But I've never been on like an official big cruise thing.
Oh, mine was an Italian cruise. So I went to Rome, Naples. Went to Pompeii. It was just all down the Italian coast. And Sicily was beautiful. And what did I sing in the amphitheater? I Will Survive. In the amphitheatre in Sicily. I can't sing. And Italy knows this.
That is very nice. I've been on a couple of cruises to the Bahamas, but now that we live in Seattle, I want to go to Alaska because it's
like, yes,
right here.
I would love to go on an Alaskan cruise. They look amazing. I don't know how much wafting can take place in an Alaskan cruise because it looks a bit chilly.
I think you can layer for wafting. I've been watching a Chinese drama called Eternal Love, which is fabulous, and involves a lot of robes, like diaphanous layers of diaphanous robes, one pale color on top of another pale color, with very trailing sleeves, but you're like completely covered. There's like very little skin showing, and you could have lots of warm things and still waft. You just layer your wafting abilities, and you know, and they do a lot of like wafting through peach forests in full bloom, and like you know, casting themselves on symbolic
cherry blossoms,
rocks,
like going behind you, don't you, swirling.
I've spent far too much time in this universe because it's a very, as is common with Chinese series dramas, extremely long, and nothing happens, really. And what does happen is extremely confusing because everybody has like 8 different names and it's all like steeped in mythology. But I can just watch it for the wafting. The wafting is enough for me.
With a notepad, making tips and hints. That, I need to do that.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, you can employ like full kimono, couldn't you? Like sort of like,
it's okay. Quite warm.
Let's Alaskan cruise waft.
Okay, all right. Let's add it to our list of things that we're going to do if we ever meet in person. Wafting.
Which are you wafting through the woods as well?
Oh, of course.
We all chose to waft.
Of course.
No, I'm going to go golf.
Oh, really?
What?
I know. I enjoy a waft. I'm keeping that for the butterfly. But there's just something amazing about donning the old velvet, going completely goth.
I have to say, I've spent my whole life wishing I could be a goth. Like, but I just don't have the chutzpah to carry it off, I don't think. Like, I just don't have it. I don't have it in me. I do understand the temptation to go goth. I just think I would be very, very bad at it. For one thing, I'm chipper and smile all the time. So I get excited about things like food. Yeah. Or wafting, and like, I think a tenet of, you know, the goth is attitude, and I don't have it. Mm-hmm. Don't have the right attitude.
Not the goth fashion.
You can't be a wafting goth.
With
an application of lace, you could.
So my friends and I used to have a saying back in the 90s when, you know, goth and grunge and everything was sort of endemic to the world. I mean, still around, but it was a big deal back then, where there was what we called the pink of goth, which is when you've gone all the way through goth to the other side and emerged into sort of gothic Lolita or whatever, which, you know, kind of is influenced by raver culture and like that kind of aesthetic, and has now become anime and like the anime thing. But we called it the pink of goth. So there is the other side of goth. But I still think that also requires a certain attitude that I just don't personally have. But I always wanted to do it, or at least try it for a while.
Yeah, I think I'll be one of those goths who you see on the adverts and, you know, they take the mick out of things. And it's the goth on the beach with the ice cream. Mm-hmm. Or on the roller coaster, and you're just like, ooh.
One of my favorite blogs on Tumblr was, for years, was Goths in Hot Weather.
Yes!
Just pictures of that. It's great.
Yes, I think great. I will be goth in hot weather.
Yeah.
Just, goth lends itself to the steampunk aesthetic a little bit easily, and it's a dream. It's a dream.
Yeah, the closest, like,
I went through a...
Sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say...
I was going to say, I went through a really big emo phase in college. Wow. So I think like that was as close as I'm ever going to get to goth.
Yeah. I did cyberpunk, which is as close as I ever got. Like I had a big... So when everyone else was doing grunge, I was like, this is not for me. So I went to mod, which was also pretty popular in like the early 90s, and threw mod into cyberpunk. Those were my cyberpunk days. And that I like that aesthetic a lot and kind of miss it. But...
I didn't go through an emo phase, and I'm kind of glad, because emo was a bad thing when I was growing up. If you were emo, oh no, you frowned upon the emo.
Wasn't goth as well?
Emo. No, goth was more accepted. Goth was much minded. Everybody, yeah. If you want, locally, goth was better than emo. Emo was the lowest on the pecking order. I don't know. I just kind of like when I got to college. I say college when I was 16, and at college in the UK, and then university. University, I was far too busy actually studying to do anything. I didn't go to university parties or anything like that. I was boring. I was studying. And at college, that's kind of when I came out of my shell a little bit and actually started getting friends and going out. And it was just kind of like, well, actually, that was my developing a personality phase and finding out who I was, not trying to get into a niche area, because I had a spectrum of friends. So I didn't feel like I needed to be in any particular area. And this sounds ridiculous, but I found jeans. I'd never owned a pair of jeans until like 17, 18, 19. I just found jeans, and that was my phase, was jeans. And that sounds really pathetic, but yeah, that was me, because I never did the emo thing or anything like that. Boots.
I think I really just did it for the excuse to wear eyeliner, a lot of it. I still wear too much eyeliner. But not as much as I did in college.
You learned how to put eyeliner on the past few years. I could never put eyeliner on until about 5 years ago.
It was high school for me. It was definitely like, college was when I was more experimental and just sort of like did crazy stuff with my look and whatever I felt like it and stuff. But high school was when I was like doing crazy, crazy colors in my hair and definitely doing the like cyber thing and, you know, like insane pigtail kind of looks and stuff. And I drove this like old beat, like really beat up pickup truck, and it didn't have nothing. It was the most basic car in the universe. It didn't have power steering or power brakes or anything, you know, so like I could kind of repair it, and I had to constantly be doing stuff to it because it was always falling apart. And we had a boom, like a little baby boom box, my best friend and I, and the boom box was with tape, a tape deck boom box that we would play music in, and it was terrible. And so we had to play the music really, really loud to be able to hear it over the sound of my beat up pickup truck, which made a ton of noise anyway. And so we would drive around in this beat up pickup way too fast. I was a terrible speed demon driver. I'm still not great about that sort of thing. Blasting really bad kind of, you know, 90s music. And it turns, and that was just what we did. Like, that was just how we lived. And like, this was before seatbelt laws. So like, I'd just pile all of my friends in the back of this pickup truck and like, you know, just go cause a ruckus places. And we were told, said best friend and I, years later, that her younger brother's age group thought of us as the bad girls. And you could not have found two people more excited in your life to have realized that they had a reputation for being bad girls in high school, because we were both total nerds. She's a mathematician. And I was, you know, and I was a freaking, you know, geeky sci-fi reading, obsessed with history kid.
Hey, there is, it's history and science and math, that's hot. That's hot. STEM, yeah, is
apparently
hot.
It's also the bad girl. That's great.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm curious as to what was in your tape deck.
Oh my God.
Did you ruin any cassette tapes? Because you played them too much?
Well, I you know, like, this was the, like, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. There's a lot of, like, mixtapes where you, like, recorded stuff off the radio. So, mm-hmm. like, the back and mm-hmm. front ends are missing. And I also got into, like, soundtracks for a long time. So, I had a lot of movie soundtrack mixtapes and stuff.
I still am. That's nice. My preferred music choice because I'm terrible with music. I'll stick a soundtrack on.
Yeah.
To this day, I have terrible taste.
I don't know anything about music.
I just like, I've never been an audiophile. Like, I've never been, I didn't go to, I'm not a concert person. I don't like gatherings of large people, large numbers of people, period. So, like, conventions are like, do I have to? Oh, fine. And I'll have fun once I'm there. But concert, I was like, I don't like any bands really enough to, you know, but I liked, you know, I love rockabilly, and I got really into, you know, like, punk covers and stuff. So, like, I'm a huge Me First and the Gimme Gimme's fan, but that was sort of after high school, that they weren't really around high school. So, like, I you know, there's a lot of early punk and stuff like that that I was playing.
Miss the days of mixtapes where you missed off half the songs. I miss those days. No, it's just playlists. I do have one playlist called Unrepentant. It's got some dodgy
stuff. You had to kind of remember which songs were on which mixtape, and you'd just be like, I want to listen to that one, but I have to listen to the whole thing to get to it.
You know? You have to forward, wind, rewind, and you had to make sure that you perfectly had tiny little handwriting on the card, and then you would no doubt put the songs in the wrong order. But, oh, God,
yes! Yes, yes, exactly.
And then if the tape came undone, you had to get a pencil and wind up back
in.
Yeah,
wind it up.
Make sure there was no creases. Mm-hmm.
That's the end of Would You Rather.
Okay.
Let's end right there. Right there in that really awkward spot. Thank you for joining us for Would You Rather.
Thank you for having me.
Hooray. Yeah. And now we have some other questions if you still have
time. Sure, let's do it.
Awesome. Okay. So there was an interview from several years ago that I read that mentions that you had notes for 7 Delightfully Deadly novellas.
Or I had nascent ideas for them. I don't know that I would dignify it with the term notes.
Is that still a thing? Are there still 7?
There are 2 out. There's a third one, which I'll be probably writing next. And then there's one more character after that who's an obvious choice. And then there's, I would say it's maybe 6, but that doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to write them all.
Can you just...
So there's 2 more obvious ones, and then there's 2 more that are like maybe.
Pillover?
I am not going to say.
Please?
Come on.
No,
please.
Monique?
I think Monique's
obvious.
Say.
I think Monique is an obvious one. If we've had pressure, Monique feels obvious as well. We need to know what happens to her.
Monique is difficult, I will say, because she, like, Prussia had so little screen time in the Vanishing School books that she's easier to redeem, whereas Monique had a lot more and would be a lot harder to redeem. So,
do you need to redeem her?
I don't.
Just let her continue to be terrible, because
yeah, but do you want to read a whole book about someone who's terrible?
Monique to be that manacled, tyrannical leader of some kind of...
You want a sort of Artemis Fowl situation.
Yeah, I don't think she does not need to turn out to be a good person. Not every person needs to be redeemed, in my opinion, and I like that. Right. I like a bad guy.
Yeah, but that's kind of my problem writing Alessandro as well, is like, I struggle to write anti-heroes. Like, I just don't, which isn't to say that I won't, it's just to say that I have a problem with it. And Alessandro has the added drawback of having a tragic ending, and I'm like, that's just not what I write, like, period. It's just not my style. So Monique is on the long list of possibilities, but as with all of my characters that end up in the novellas or in the spin-offs, I have to have an idea that it works for them. Like, I have to have them like spring into my head and be like, we're going to do this thing. Like, Dimity was like, we're going to go rescue a vampire hive that's going to God. Like, so, ooh. And I was like, oh, great. We can write that. Let's do it. So I need that to happen.
Going to God.
Yeah.
You see, as soon as Pillover turned up and he was in Oxford Don, I was like, right, where is his and Percy's story where they kind of like meet and have a few whiskeys and reminisce over some stupidity that their sisters have got
over Latin? They would have an entire conversation in Latin.
They would have a Latin off, and it would be in the Japanese Club. It just needs to be one of those, like, you know, half a dozen pages short story things. Like, yeah, it doesn't need to be a full thing, but it just needs to be them bemoaning their sisters for a while. I'm like, yes,
goodness sake, why were we saddled with such sisters?
Exactly. Oh, that's so delightful.
Yeah, I would love to read that. That would be great.
I remember getting the message off Amanda when Pillover turned up. She was like, Pillover! Pillover's in the house! Yes. Yes, he is.
I was so excited. I was so excited for Pillover to show up.
There he is, little girl Boo-Ann.
So, I was wondering, as I've been reading through all of the books multiple times, Lord Akeldama, he is obviously like the character in all of the Parasol verse. He's there. He is manipulating everything. Did you originally intend for him to be so popular when you introduced him in Solace and have the backstory there? Because it's evolved, like seriously become evolved. I didn't even think about who he was pre-bite. And then all of a sudden I know who he was pre-bite. And it's like, he's done this. He's done it. He had part of it. What? It's like, was it there?
Maybe half the time, I guess. I always knew that he was. So I always knew that he was behind a lot of stuff, and that he was. So I always wrote him with Oscar Wilde and the Scarlet Pimpernel in my head. Yes. So those are the two pulls that I had for him the most in terms of like his characterization and stuff. And the Scarlet Pimpernel thing was definitely like, he has his little mitts in thing, you know, like it's this fabulousness, which is him, is also the front that like distracts people from realizing all of the stuff he's actually doing in the background. So that was always intentional. And he's always been a kind of instrument of my writer's subconscious. So because I knew he was there and kind of in control and manipulating things in the background, I always knew when he tends to come in, and this is going to sound schizophrenic, but he tends to come in when I'm writing a scene with him and like just start conversations and start talking about stuff that is occasionally off topic for the book that I'm actually writing. But I always let him do that, and I let him keep, and I keep it in the scene, because it's often my subconscious seeding for future books. And sometimes the seeding won't drop. And, you know, like sometimes it's something that's like seeded in Changeless and it's not going to drop until Defy or Defend or something. Right.
Yeah.
And if I let him do that, that's what's going on. And that's clearly, he's just this sort of background networking that's going on in my brain for, you know, plot reasons or what have you. And I use him primarily as that tool, because he can allude to things without ever actually addressing them directly. And then I can pick it up later and make fun and play with it. You know, like the Sophronia and the girls being in the background and manipulating and countering him in many ways, or, you know, like having this sort of ongoing game, which is dropped in Reticence, is this fact. That was later, that was introduced later.
Yeah.
But he's there from the very, very beginning and always has. And he turns up in almost every single book I've written. And then there's a couple where he doesn't have any on-screen time, but he usually turns up at some point.
If he's not physically there, at least he's referenced in some way, shape or form. And it's always delightful. I absolutely adore that scene in Reticence. After I read Poison or Protect, I had to go back to Reticence. Because it was about the colour of Precious Eyes. I was like, this is familiar. I know this has happened before. And I had to go back to Reticence to actually revisit with Arsenic. And then there's the whole debate over her having pansy coloured eyes. I was like, yes, yes, Amanda, pansy eyes, pansy eyes. Absolutely delightful just hearing it again and just getting that perfect lineup of the storyline. It was just like, oh, my heart is singing. This is so sweet. And then saw that scene at the wedding when just all there is Aunt Softie. Oh god, you're an idiot. It's so you're smart, but you lack a lot of common sense, dude. Oh, it's delightful. I wish I had those type of people in my life, but you know.
Yeah. Except you would just never know whether your own life was yours or being decided by others, right?
I think it's quite clear throughout, nobody has a say in them. I mean, to be fair, though, I mean, you can't make somebody fall in love, but the sure as heck try.
Yeah. Can sure as heck give them the opportunity to encounter the person you think is correct for them in a strategic manner.
But they're really good at it as well, so that shouldn't be denied, the fact that excellent actual matchmakers, you know, if they put the minds to it and turned into those like stereotypical matchmaking mamas of the London season, I mean, nobody would stand a chance.
Okay, so if Lord Akeldama is always there, do you have a favorite character that like goes unnoticed or unsqueed about in the Parasolverse? Like who's your favorite that's the opposite of Lord Akeldama?
That's not the one that everybody gravitates towards. That's a good question. I don't know, because like there are definitely characters that like I feel an immense amount of affection for, but sort of like went under the radar. Like Flute is one of those, but Flute has his advocates. Lyle has always been one of my favorite characters, but again, Lyle has his advocates.
I'm in that fan club. I love Lyle.
Yeah, I am more attracted, like I adore Lord Akeldama, don't get me wrong, but I tend to be more attracted to, like, personality wise, the quietly capable characters.
Yes.
Like characters that like maybe don't say very much, they sort of show up and like just have the snack that you need, or how like have the answer, or you know, like I sort of
send down the tea and crumpets. Yeah,
exactly. And that's like just the less dramatic people, and they just don't sparkle on the page in the same way, because that's not what their personality is, their whole personality is. So I tend to really love, and I think that's part of the reason I've written so many of that kind of character in the San Andreas books, is because the Parasolvers by its nature doesn't really lend itself to those characters as much. Because, you know, appearance and sparkle and, you know, that is so much a part of the steampunk world. Whereas if I'm writing, you know, contemporary paranormal romance, then like that, you know. But people still go for the sunshine bunnies in the San Andreas, you know, like they still really gravitate towards like Marvin and those characters, because they like how sparkly they are. But I do tend to really love like kind of, like I call them like the Buddha characters, which are sort of these sort of calm, centered, quiet background characters. It does tend to be those. Like Gavin is one of my favorite characters I've ever written, and he just doesn't come up very much, and I'm like, I just love Gavin and his dainty sandwiches. Such a sweetie.
That was my favorite part. That was my favorite part of Poison to Protect. Gavin eating all the tiny sandwiches.
Like,
that was my
favorite part. Insubstantial, and he's like such a big guy, and he's like, I'm still hungry.
But he seemed to enjoy them so much.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you.
We spent a lot of time talking about Agatha in our last episode when we were talking about Poison to Protect, and we were talking about her being in the background of everything, and we like decided just ourselves that she is in every book, whether she's mentioned or not. She's like behind the potted plant, or she's like over here behind the curtains, nobody knows that she's
nobody
there.
Nobody ever notices her, so obviously she can be everywhere.
Yeah.
I think she...
We wrote our own Agatha.
Agatha is one of those characters as well, I think. She's like, in my books, a lot of them tend to be male, but I think you're right. I think Agatha is one of those. The interesting thing about those characters from my personal perspective is trying to climb into their brains and figure out why they do what they do and why they are who they are and why they let themselves be so completely in the background, and what motivates that kind of behavior. As someone who is introverted but like performs extroversion really, really well, and obviously I go on podcasts and stuff, like, you know, I'm clearly not that kind of personality at all. And one of the great joys of being a writer is exploring personalities not your own. So Agatha is another one that interests me quite a bit. Having not yet written her, I like written from her perspective, I don't know if mm-hmm. she's going to turn out to be a favorite or not. but yeah, I would say that that is a personality, like that is a character type that I really love and like unlike putting on the page, but often doesn't get seen. That's part of the point.
When I was rereading Reticence and thinking about Agatha, especially after reading Poison Protect, and she's the one that got the information about her father. It's never explicitly said, but it's inferred that that's who she thinks. I was thinking Agatha's like Sophronia. Sophronia is very loud and brash, and she, you know, the Wicker Chicken has been involved in some way, method or form. But Agatha being the Wallflower, you know, I can imagine her doing bigger, greater, more complex things than what Sophronia is, but that's because she's hiding behind the potted plant. You don't see that she's there. She's just this master of disguise and a complete chameleon. And I don't think within the finishing school you really totally appreciate, not until the very, very end, how much of a chameleon that she is. Because she always seems to be there and she has skills, but it's never a celebrated set of skills. And then all of a sudden she's in Japan and she's like, oh yes, I found all of this information. And then it's just, you forget about it and she comes back and you forget about it and she comes back. And it's like, she must be phenomenal. She must have traveled the world and put sort of all the rights of the world and being like, right, okay, this is not how it's going to be. This is how it's going to be. But you ain't going to find out that it's me who did it. And it's just like, I really need to know more about Agatha. And for me, it's like, she could have her own series of books in and of themselves, because I can imagine. I mean, I'm not putting any pressure onto you here. I'm not pressurizing you, but it just seems like she has had such an eventful life that it could be in and of itself, you know, its own series, because you never know where she is, and it's fantastic. And she might be behind me right now.
Exactly. And you can, I think you can see why Lord Akeldama would figure her out and track her down too, because she is almost like the antithesis of him in what she can do, right? And what she has the capacity to accomplish. Yes. Because he uses the fact that he is always visible and he is always the center of attention as a distraction. And she's exactly the opposite, right?
Yes.
So they're both kind of intelligentsiers and they're both sort of masters of spycraft and espionage, but in completely the opposite ways. And I always liked that idea. I mean, I was one of the reasons I gave Alexia originally the ability that I gave her, which is no ability whatsoever. It is the ability to cancel other people out. I like exploring the idea of power as vested in something that doesn't manifest as powerful. I think that's why I like playing with spies and controlling and information and manipulating information as part of like a large part of my books. And so like in a way, Agatha could be perceived as one of the most powerful characters I've ever written, because she goes completely unnoticed all of the time. And therefore she's probably there and probably knows things more than any other character, and who she chooses to tell and who notices her and who she gives her loyalty to is then can become power players because she's not going to do that. Like she's not gonna her, like I feel like in thinking about her, that her motivation is just getting the information. That is what's satisfying to her.
Yes.
Is like finding the thing out and knowing it herself. And so in the end, she's not interested in being in power or making use of that. And so like who she then passes information on to is going to be the person who really does have the power, because she's not going to make use of it. All of her joy and all of her satisfaction is in just getting it. And that's a very kind of interesting role to play, is somebody who plays someone who's essentially playing the game not to win, but just for joy of the game. Sophronia plays the game to win it. She plays the game to change the world in a way that she wants it to be changed. Like that's her personality. Mm-hmm. That's the brashness that you're identifying, right? Agatha plays the game because she likes the game. And maybe she'll play it to lose, and maybe she'll play it to a draw simply for the satisfaction of manipulating it and knowing that she is playing it in a way that no one else can predict.
Yeah, that's you don't know. I mean, even as a creator, you don't necessarily know. I described Agatha when I was talking about it to my husband as I described her as the squirrel girl of the parasol verse. And for those who don't know Marvel, Squirrel Girl is a girl who looks like a squirrel, and she defeated Thanos off page. And she's the only person to have ever solely defeated Thanos and took no credit for it. It was just, it happened. Nobody saw it, but you found out about it. And that's, for me, Agatha. She could defeat Thanos and you wouldn't know about it, but she would.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's all that matters, exactly, as far as she's concerned. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Fantastic.
One of those things. So, I mean, you said
you can imagine her with like a checklist that's like, you know, groceries, steal this piece of paperwork from the home office, defeat
stop
Thanos,
the pudding war, stop the manical evil leader,
yeah. Take a shower, happy.
Discover a new species of shifter.
Yes.
You know she knows if mermaids are shifters or not. You know she knows all of this. You think the custard, the spotted custard crew have found all of these vampires and shifters on their own themselves? No. She's got an entire filing cabinet full of documents to prove that she's integrated into their society and got all of this information. The more I think about Agatha, the more I'm drawn to her as a character, and I'm like, she's not in enough. Mm-hmm.
But she is, because she's in all of them. We already decided this. She's there.
I feel like I'm writing my own fan fiction right now. I always do this, don't I? I always write my own fan fiction in my head. If I had a Tumblr, it would just be full of fan fiction over everything. I'm busy writing it right now in my head. This is crazy. So, speaking of fan fiction, do you ever write stories about your characters for yourself? Like, you've said Dharma will talk to you, and this is a common thing I've heard with writers, that their characters speak to them, tell them about things that have nothing to do with the current book at hand, but it's obviously, it's useful for future stories. Do you kind of like ever write stories in your head about your characters that have never seen the published light of day, you know, so essentially your own fan fiction?
Not really. I mean, one of the reasons I spun off to do indie stuff is so I could essentially write my own fan fiction. So like at this juncture, that's what happens, is like, if I have a great idea for a story featuring a side character, then I'll write it down and, you know, something will happen with it eventually, I hope. There are a few, like, I have some flash pieces and short notations on like things that have happened to certain characters. Like, so scenes have come to me. I'll give you an example, which if Ty is listening is going to drive them crazy, but like I have this scene where Sophronia and Sidhag are talking in the docks after Sidhag comes back with the mummy. So this is from Changeless, from way, way, way back when, right? So the Kingar pack brought the mummy and the plague and the humanite, like the mortality plague back from Egypt. And like, of course, Sophronia has something to do with all of this. And they're meeting on the dock to discuss the fact, you know, when Madame LeFou is about to be brought in, and like, you know, there's a whole reason that Sidhag and Madame LeFou have to pretend not to know each other when Madame LeFou ends up in Kingair. And so like, and Sophronia is sort of setting this up, and I have that sort of thing written, like that bit is written. Because I had to explain why Madame LeFou and Sidhag pretend not to know each other and Changeless. And so when I came up with the explanation for that, I just wrote that scene down. So that scene exists. Yeah. Right. And so I have little things like that, mostly because I've written them so that I don't forget what I wanted. So I have sort of a collection of bits, but they don't qualify as stories by any stretch of the imagination. So, I can't really do anything with them until they become part of something else or something larger, or I can pick them up and plop them into to a different book. So, like, you know, there's a possibility that someday I will have to write and Sidhag is one of those characters that shows up so much in so many different books that, like, if I ever write the Sidhag story, it's going to have all these, like, what I would call interstitial pieces in it and some sort of linking premise. you know, so I have kind of like, and that's just a work, that's just like going to be a lot of work for me. So it would take a while to write it. And then, but, and so mostly I don't, like, I don't do anything with those. They just sort of sit in the background somewhere until like I need them. And I haven't yet. The exception to that, it was recently. So I wrote The Enforcer Enigma at the beginning of this year, and it's about to come out. It's like the, one of the fastest pieces I've ever pushed into production. Mm-hmm. And that one does not deal with mana and Lovejoy. And my early readers and my beta readers all were like, what happened? What's going on with that couple? And I was like, they're such a minor sideline couple. But, you know, there's this one fight sequence in the Omega Objection where Mana goes into the fray, and she's like so emotionally invested and upset because Lovejoy is in danger. And that like hit people in a way that I didn't realize how importantly it had hit people. Yeah. And one of my trans fans on Twitter was like, the thing to understand about Lovejoy is that essentially he's a straight white dude who like falls deeply in love with a trans woman. And it and isn't shaken by this and doesn't like doesn't consider it having affected his own sexual orientation in any way. He's in love with a woman, he's still a straight dude, right? Like it doesn't like and they were just like, that's so important psychologically to the trans community to like have the idea that there are people like that out in the world. And I was like, oh fuck, I messed up. Like, oh, they're a really important couple. And I didn't like, I was like, well, you know, from a purely plot perspective, they didn't play into the plot of The Enforcer Enigma. And so like, I had that in the background of my brain. And then I woke up one morning recently and like, I was like, oh, they have a tiny little short story. And it is, and then it just wrote it out in like 4 hours or something. Wow. And it's a very short story, and it's just them. And it's just a sort of window insight into their relationship and what goes on and why Mana leaves, and it's important enough, but it is again completely interstitial. It doesn't have a beginning, middle, or an end. You have to have read like all three books in the San Andreas series to know it. And like, this is weird because the San Andreas books are written so you can read each one of them individually if you want to. It's they each one are a complete story, but Mana and Lovejoy's tiny little relationship is like dropped in nugget form into each three books. And then I wrote this sort of catch-up story, but you have to have read all of the other little bits, and I'm not going to go in and extract them and rewrite them or anything. And that is normally something that I just would not put out into the universe because it's essentially like fan fiction. Like you really have to have sort of been involved in this universe first. But I will make an exception in this case, and I am going to eventually put it out because it is important to my fans and my readers. So, you know, like something that I have never done in the past is something that I will do in the future. And I have to say that that is entirely based on the fact that I have such an intimate relationship with my readers, but also that I can experiment in how to put it out into the world in a way that I never could with traditional. Yeah. Like traditional, if you wrote something like that, the only thing you could do is couple it at the back end of a book, like stick it in as a little extra at the end of The Enforcer Enigma. But it so breaks with the tone, and it's such a different thing, and it's completely different characters and stuff that like I feel like it would ruin the reader experience if I put it at the end of The Enforcer Enigma. So I just did not even entertain that idea. So I'm just gonna have to put it, I will eventually just put it out on its own, and I just have to, and because I can be experimental with it and figure it out, you know, and how to do it and everything, I will. Whereas I maybe, you know, if this were 5 years ago, I wouldn't do something like that. So, and we'll see how that goes. And that will be the experiment. I use the San Andreas books to experiment a lot because, you know, it's a different, less fanatical base than the Parasolverse fans. And if it goes okay, and if I don't get a bunch of pissed off people on Amazon leaving angry reviews because the story isn't really a story, you know, and you have to have read all this other stuff first, then, you know, I might do more going forward in the future, but we'll see with this one how it goes.
To be fair, I mean, it's not the first time I've ever read like the 3.5 of a series where you have to read the other ones because, again, they're minor characters. but you want to find out that little bit extra about them and you need to flesh that character out. But totally, it doesn't fit in a main series.
And exactly.
If you're a reader and appreciate the written word and appreciate that a writer has to make, it's like making a movie or TV series. You can't have absolutely everything in it, otherwise it totally will not work.
Yeah.
And you want one thing to suffer for the sake of having this inserted in somewhere and for it not to be right. I would rather have a quality book that I'm going to enjoy from cover to cover and then have something that's on the side that I can enjoy in and of itself as a fan. It's like it's like when you have those little pieces of like dropping the Wicked Chicken in your main in one thing and you're it's Sophronia, and in your main series it's kind of like you're giving that little fan service.
yes I call it cookies for the careful reader, which is basically like I try to write so if you read the book knowing nothing else about the Parasolverse, especially the novellas and the standalones, that it wouldn't, that the story and the characters are gonna still leap off the page and you'll have an enjoyable experience. But if you have read my other stuff and you are really careful and you do read every sentence that I've put on the page, you're gonna get a cookie. You're gonna be like, here, super fan, like, here's your cookie, like, here's your Wicker Chicken, or like, here's an allusion to the Wallflower, or like a side mention of a, you know, of a drone that's clearly a Lord Akeldama drone who's like standing in the background at a party or something, right? Like, so I'll give little cookies out.
Yeah. It is calorific. It's highly calorific.
Fortunately, it's not actually going to pack on the pounds onto your hips. But I think that stems entirely from that exact experience. Like, I feel like if I had come of age a decade later, you know, when the internet was a thing, I am old. The internet was not a thing when I was young. I would have been like a crazy fanfic writer, like, because that's always all I wanted was to like, you know, like, have Tamora Pierce drop a side, you know, of what happens with X, like minor character or something, you know? And so I would have gone deep, deep into fanfic. I just missed the boat entirely. And so I just wrote my own.
It's probably the best that I missed that, to be fair. Cause
I would have been lost. I would have been lost to fanfic for a very long time and not written my own stuff, I feel like. But that's why I write the way I write is because I come from such a like reader, like an obsessive reader background. And so like, I like to give that back to people. I feel like, not to be sappy, but like genuinely lucky that I am in a time and place and age in terms of like electronic books and stuff that like allows me to just be experimental and be like, what do you guys think of it? Should I give this to you? Does that work? Oh, no? Okay, fine. We won't do that again. You know, that kind of thing.
Did you ever realize that when you wrote Solace, how important your books were going to be to the LGBTQ plus community?
I had no idea. And I talk about this in, you know, I have a old blog post that's basically like queer characters blame Mercedes Lackey. Because what reading Mercedes Lackey did for me as a kid was normalize representation. And so, you know, when like the time came for me to write it, I was always automatically going to normalize representation. There's always going to be queer rep in my books. My problem with Mercedes Lackey is she often kills her queers or gives them tragic endings. And so I was like, all right, so like, I don't write that. I write comedy. I don't write drama. And so what we're going to do is like give all my queer characters happy endings and happy ever afters. You know, and full lives and like, you know, complete personalities and all that sort of stuff. And so, it was just like intrinsic to how I write. Like, it just never even, things like Alexia's bi, and it just like never occurred to me that anybody would think otherwise. I was like, and partly that's because I go into meeting almost every person assuming that they're queer, and then they have to prove straightness to me. I'm always like, yeah, just justify that choice you've made, straight person. So, you know,
I always got the impression that Alexia was pan, like, because of being soulless and not necessarily having those emotions that everybody, people with swords have. I always thought of her as more pansexual. That's why
I conflate pan and bi all the time, because again, old, and so bi was it until like the young people came along and were like, we're gonna do pan, and I was like, fine.
I've tried to educate myself on the different sexualities and gender pronouns and norms, because it's only right and it's only respectful. Yes. So yeah,
it's only fair.
It was bi when I was younger, like that's what I grew up knowing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As being, yes. But obviously I understand that the spectrum has gloriously technical enough.
Yes, it has totally evolved. I am bi, so I own bi, and so I'm like, I'll just like take that one. So yeah, that's why I still run with it, you know, because I'm old-fashioned. I do that with my, so, but to answer your question, I had no idea Solas would be popular at all. Like, I had no idea it was, like, I genuinely, I think a lot of authors are like this, but, like, I genuinely was like, it is a weird, quirky little book that is, that, like, disobeys so many rules in terms of it isn't nested completely in any specific genre. It won YA awards, right? Like, it isn't even really nested in any age bracket, you know, so it's unmarketable. Like, and it's a comedic genre fiction written by a woman, which also is uncommon and unpopular. Like, it has a strong romance backbone, and I make no, like, apologies for that. And it like ends happily. It's not like tragic or dramatic or, you know, like all of these things that for a book to get acclaim, you tend to, you know, have to, especially in genre, which is already fighting an uphill battle of stigmatism.
Yeah.
So like, I was like, yeah, not, it's just going to be like, it will find some readers, and the readers it finds who love it are going to really, really love it. But like, I assumed it would be more like, you know, kind of like Sherwood Smith or something. Like, there are some obscurer authors out there who I think write great stuff, but like tend to be basically cults. And I was like, I just always assumed Solas would do the same thing.
Solas always sits in my local bookshop. It's always sat in the sci-fi section. Custard Protocol and Finishing School have always sat in the YA section.
Which makes no sense.
Yeah, sometimes they do mix them up. Or sometimes I mix them up for them. Whilst alphabetizing their bookshelves, I'm one of those, yes. And it's, again, one of those things where I look at the bookshelves and I don't see a lot of female writers within the sci-fi genre. And that's where they tend to put steampunk in sci-fi fantasy section. And it always seems like it must be... We talked about this with Bridget Tyler, who wrote The Pioneer, which is a great sci-fi book. And addresses racial and sexuality, and she does it in a very brilliant way as well. But how difficult it must be to be a female writer, or you know, a writer who identifies female as well, that is in the sci-fi section, because it's filled with men, white men.
Especially, I mean, like, I hate to say it, but it is worse in the UK.
No, I agree. I complain about this pretty much every other week to Amanda, how it's always the same bloody people on the bookshelf, and I struggle to get a lot of the books that we cover on the podcast if it wasn't for my magical fairy godmother.
It's not like that here. You can get all of these books all over the place from the library. You can get them. They're there. They're for you. And she's like, no, it's not like that here.
I think we could talk about this for an entire podcast, but there is a strong conflation in the UK, way stronger than in the US, between science fiction in particular and literary fiction. There are in a strange way, it is a positive, because commercial genre fiction fights a lot of stigmatisms in the market in general. But in the UK, for some reason, a bunch of white dudes who are also physicists at Oxford or whatever would write sci-fi, you know, and that that was given literary merit in a way that it really has really never happened in the US so far as I know. And this is like not my area of academic study, but you get somebody like Ian Banks, for example, who's also Ian M. Banks, who's always done really, really well in the UK, never did as well in the US. has kind of lit, and he, the Ian M. Banks stuff, I think it's the M, but is lit. And then like, he also writes the sci-fi as Ian Banks or vice versa, one way or the other. But his sci-fi gets very literary covers and his style is very literary, even when he's writing sci-fi. And like and in the UK, they allow like this sort of cerebral exploration sci-fi, like Charlie Strauss or, who else does it? China Mieville, like, is way more popular there. Like, what would, like, hard sci-fi that also explores, you know, social structures and questions and sociality and, you know, themes of existence. And like these like very literary themes are tackled in sci-fi. So it has had a positive effect in that critics evaluate science fiction in particular as one of the commercial genres more commonly in the UK than they do in the US. And then the downside, of course, is that the only ones who are really permitted into that sphere are older white men. And that the only things that are given merit are ones that have by the sort of existential criteria dictated by white male critics, validation or like a certain level of weight that allows them to be taken seriously. And that has had this, I think, this trickle down effect on the shelves in the UK. I honestly believe that.
The latest James Patterson you can get, not interested in the fella. No. But PC Cast, for example, I can't even get out of my bookshelf store. This is just me mourning. We're going to be covering Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion in a couple of weeks' time. And that was a big movie. And my local library has no copies available. not audio, not physical. And I'm like, helpful.
Can you not request it?
No.
Oh. No. Wow. No.
It's like they just don't exist, and unless it's Stephen King,
yeah,
J.K. Rowling, unfortunately, at the moment, who I'm,
I mean,
she
but there's
has
the
three bookshelves full, and there's only seven books.
The flip side of this is it's also the responsibility of the buyer's end of the spectrum to make a stink about it, and to, when you go into your bookstore and they don't have it, to like march up and be like, buy this, get this book for me, like get this female author for me, get this black author for me, like you, like, and the British hate to make a stink about anything, but like it like your money is what talks the loudest to everybody in the chain of command, from, you know, acquisitions at agencies to editors to publishing houses. And if you're not spending your dollar and your energy and your voice to ask for these books, then they're nothing. Like, complaining about it on a podcast doesn't do any good whatsoever.
No.
Right?
Like, I'm terrible. I'm not British in my complaints. So I enjoy a good complaint to these people, but you know,
yeah, but if you go up and you say, look, I mean, you just go up to the counter and be like, I would be spending X amount of money in your shop if you had these books. Like, get these books. I'll come back in 3 days and spend money.
Like, I've bought some I bought the entire Varney the Vampire Penny Dreadfuls from my local bookshop. And they were like, are you seriously wanting this one? You should have it on the shelves. I realize they're over 100 years old, but you should have them on your shelves. Now, can you please get X, Y, and Z? And it's not that I come in with just the author. I come with the ISBNs. There's no excuse not to be able to get me the books.
Yeah.
But this is where online bookshops are great, because now I have access to an entire country of indie bookshops.
Yes. Borderlands, my local bookstore, will ship anywhere in the world. And they are ready to do it for you. And if you order one of my books through them, they will send it to you signed, because I sign all their stock for them. So, like, I mean, yeah. And that's like, in the end, that's the niche where an indie bookstore is going to survive, is in being able to provide, you know, to the global market that really wants and can't get, you know.
Just wish postage and packaging wasn't so expensive.
Ooh. That is the problem. But that's not dictated by anybody. That's just like, you want a book shipped international,
it's gonna, and to be fair, if you want the book, you'll pay at the price, and I'm happy to pay at the price if it gets me what I want. So
it's worth it. And then, you know, your money is supporting people that you love, so it's great. All of it's great, and the shipping doesn't count, but The book does.
When I eventually come over to America again, I'm going to have to bring an empty suitcase just to fill with books. The dream is to go to LA and go to the Ripped Bodice bookshop as well. I follow them on Twitter and I adore them. It's just
they're awesome.
Yeah, Amanda won't come with me, I don't think, but well, it's books, but it's romance books. It's all romance books.
I know. They're great.
I just love it.
Yeah, they're awesome. I love them very, very much. I was supposed to be down in LA, but of course that trip got canceled. And one of the sojourns was going to be across LA, which let me tell you, is like 2 hours to get to the Ripped Bodice to just to pay them a visit and say hi. But
I want to go to the Second Shelf in London, which is just an all-women's bookshop. And they're very vocal in supporting trans women as well. And it's like, I just need to go there and just stand in their shelves and smell all of the lovely books. And then hopefully be able to afford something.
way back in the day, I had a signing at Foyles in London, which was, you know, kind of like the thing, like the pinnacle of the thing that you can achieve. And to this day, my mother laments the fact that my grandmother, who was a writer, a nonfiction writer, but a writer, had died before her granddaughter got to sign at Foyles, because that would have been like the thing, like that would have been the picture my grandma had of me would have been me at Foyles.
excellent. Amanda, do you have a cosplay question?
Yes, I always have cosplay questions. Is there a character that you have never seen anyone cosplay, but you desperately want someone to do it? Because I will accept all challenges.
You can't say Agatha, because she's probably been done, you've just never noticed.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I've never seen a Dimity. I mean, I've seen... Okay. So I've seen a Dimity that was part of a sewing project. I wouldn't really qualify though. It's sort of cosplay, but it's not cosplay, because I think of cosplay as something that's done for the convention circuit. Like, you know, it's done to go out into the world and for like other fans to see you being a fan of something. And that was more like a school project thing. So I've never seen, so I should say, I've never seen a Dimity in the wild. How's that?
Being free through the forest.
Yes. Yeah, so that would be one. I've never seen any of my trans characters, but I think that, you know, they should probably be portrayed by people who identify with them, maybe. I don't know. Like, that's an interesting thought, moral quandary. But I think she's one of the few. I'd like to see a Tesseract. I've never seen a Tesseract.
We did come up with a Tesseract like at Christmas time. We were talking about different characters. I mean, we came up with the Spotted Custard, for goodness sake, as a cosplay. And we did discuss a Tesseract, but it was probably a little bit too much skin that would be comfortable for social media.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of the characters from the Custer Protocol, I've never seen. So I've seen a Prudence and I've seen a Spoo, but I've never seen any of the other characters from that series.
Love an arsenic.
Yes.
Dreams of becoming arsenic.
Honestly, arsenic and Faith have some of my favorite fashion looks. I love dress reform. And so they both wear dress reform. And so like I rode them because I had a friend when I worked at the Dickens Fair who would wear dress reform, but would wear authentic, like ground up, like built from the ground up from Victorian pattern dress reform outfits. And so I think about those in terms of that's such a work. But yeah, I'd love to see like a full proper arsenic bicycle outfit.
Yes, with bag.
Yeah.
And if the bag actually worked, oh my lord, that would be amazing. That'd be a feat.
Yeah.
I dream of having that bicycle outfit.
Yeah, wouldn't that be like, but I think that would just be a fun. I wrote those, like I wrote both those characters' outfits to be things that like could like were comfortable to wear and you could like march around a convention all day long, you know, like in your
but no one's
you the
no
cosplay idea, please. See, that's what I like about arsenic. I mean, she's so practical.
Right. She's got her bag. Like, she can carry, you can carry everything you would need at a convention. Like, she's like, everything is there on her, like on her person and, you know, ready to go. Like, she seems like, yeah. So yeah.
I would hope they'd have a CV in the bag as well, just to whip that out and just hand it out to people.
Yes. Yes.
That would be absolutely perfect. That's the dream.
Other questions? Do we have any more questions, ladies?
Yes. Oh my God. What do you always hope that someone will ask you and they never do?
Generally the conversation turns towards food at some point. Like, my favorite thing to talk about is food. So that's always what I'm hoping. I'm hoping we get onto the subject of food, and we already did. That tends to be, you know, what I like to talk about. Yeah. But I don't have a specific thing that people have been waiting to be asked.
So you just want people to ask you directly about food, not having to skirt around the fact.
Yeah, or just like I just...
And tie things in. Just have a conversation.
What are you having for your tea tonight?
That's a really good question. I haven't really decided yet. There are some bagels, so I'm like, I'm thinking about a bagel avocado sandwich. That might be what I have for dinner. I'm a total NorCal, like, eater of small...
avocados,
small vegetable based meals. That tends to be like most of the time. It's not that exciting, I'm afraid.
I'm a terrible millennial and I am not a fan of an avocado, but if it was a bagel, it would be cream cheese on it for me.
Yeah, I'm off all dairy at the moment for various reasons. I'm off lactate, so like I have a lactate free milk in my tea and stuff, so I'm doing fine, but it does mean no cream cheese. No soft cheeses right now, sadly. No cheese at all. I know.
So oh no.
I know. I'm.
Oh no.
But I don't think it's permanent. We'll see. But so I think I'll be okay.
I hope it's not.
Is there anything you can shout out about? Anything you can tell us about future projects?
Well, I talked about the Enforcer Enigma is coming out, and for those who like the sort of quietly capable and the sort of more mildly mannered sweetheart characters, this is probably the sweetest of the San Andreas books that I've written. Oh. It's very gentle and very sweet. And sort of, you know, kind of tackles with like loneliness and self-worth and that kind of thing. But everything comes out fine in the end. It's all upbeat. Don't worry. And I think it has one of the funniest scenes I've maybe ever written, which is a bunch of werewolves at a country music concert who are trying to be the bodyguards for a singer, and none of them like country music. And
you should have opened with that one.
It is their calm conversation between each other juxtaposed with the country music lyrics that I have written special. So, and I wrote them. So,
Oh, I can't wait for that.
Oh, goodness. Yeah,
so that, I'm very excited about that. That comes out August 1st. I don't know when this is going to drop. And then after that, I'm going to drop The Heroine's Journey in the fall, which is my nonfiction book. So, yeah.
I'm so excited for that one.
Yeah. So it is basically a rebuttal to Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, which is basically like, look, there's a heroine's journey. It exists. It's always existed. It's different. Here's what it comes from. Here are a couple of pop culture books that I use to show you how it works. And then here's a breakdown of how to write it and how to identify it, basically.
Ah, so, excellent.
Yeah. I think you mentioned that one the very, very, very first time you were on the podcast 100 million years ago.
I have been working on it.
Like episode 11.
A long time. Yeah.
I've been looking forward to it since then. I'm very excited about it.
It will happen. It's happening. It's because I learned about it in college, studying the Homeric hymns and the Hymn to Demeter and, you know, Ishtar and the Isis myths, and thought that everybody else knew about it. And turns out that no, because I would just casually mention it on conventions for years and years and years, and then I would inevitably have to explain it to people, and it's not something that it can be really explained in the course of like five sentences. Like, you need a book. Mm-hmm. And so finally I've just been waiting for someone else to write the book, which is exactly how Solas came into existence. Is I was waiting for someone else to write it, and eventually I was like, okay, so she who spots the problem is responsible for the solution. So I've been sort of quietly working on this for a really long time, and I finally decided that I just have to bite the bullet and put it out into the world. even if it's just a patch until somebody more qualified comes along.
I keep expecting somebody to drop a book on fashion, like the Victorian style fashions, because you're always retweeting and reblogging about and using inspirations, except you'll have the foreword to it, right? Obviously the expert will write it, but forward by Gail Carriger, and I keep expecting that to happen. So that'd, if anybody fun. Wants to do that, please, because I would love just like a magazine style fashion book with those and your forward in the front and inspirational notes and stuff. I think that would
be cool if it were one like that specifically for authors, so you could, like, in other words, so that it, like, clearly defined in descriptive terms, like, how the fashion's changed, and with imagery, like, one from the next, men and women, you know, kind of that kind of thing.
It's like taking a Pinterest board and actually putting it on a coffee table with annotations.
I think, it's really interesting. One of the things is, like, when you become an author, there are sort of, like, mile markers that you know that you hit and that are going to be exciting, like, earning out your advance, or when you first see your book on a shelf in a store, or when you first see somebody reading your book, like, who you don't know, like, on a train or something, right? Like, there's these exciting things that, like, are mile markers that you hit. And then there are all these ones that you don't know. And being asked to write a foreword for one of my favorite books of all time was, like, a mile marker that I was like, oh, I got this one. You know, like, I was like, oh, I didn't even know that I got to have that on a list.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when I was asked, that was The Forgotten Beasts of Eld, which is literally one of my favorite books. And, like, I'd just written a Goodreads review about it because it's one of my favorite books. And they were doing a re-release and they contacted me and said, would you like to write the foreword? And I was like, oh, I get to do that? Like, oh. Yeah.
So. Can I tell you in 3 days when I learn how to breathe again? Thank you very much. That's amazing. That is amazing. Yeah. This is why a book at this should never end.
It's true. It's true. But, like, those kinds of, like, mile markers are the ones that I think you experience the most sort of unfettered joy, because the act of, like, not even knowing you should look forward to it is, like, part of the charm.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So thank you. Thank you so much for joining us
again. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. I love talking to you. So
thank you.
Good. We love you. Hopefully, you know, we might have to discuss a nonfiction book.
Sorry.
That's fine.
It's written very me. Like, I was just like, look, I can't even pretend to be an academic about this, so I'm just going to write it for fun. And it, like, that's kind of a meta part of the discussion, because kind of part of the discussion is, like, the heroine's journey gets critically disenfranchised because it tends to be lighter hearted and happily ending and, like, all and about, like, connecting with people and relationships and love. And so, like, critics disregard it as somehow less important because it's dealing with the positive things in life. And so I was like, so I'm just going to write it upbeat and positive and chirper and me-ish and sort of casual and stuff. Because of its topic, it's going to get polarized no matter what I do. So I might as well write it in a way that's fun to read. So it should be fun to read.
I may pre-order mine and have it shipped over signed from America, because I am that excited. I will suffer the shipping cost. I don't mind.
It should be, I mean, it'll be in the UK for, you know, POD. I'll find
it. Yes, but it like won't that. Be signed. And if it I get be. It from your bookshop, then I will get a signed copy.
Yes.
And I haven't got a signed one on my bookshelf yet. It is the dream to have a signed copy.
Wait, don't you have the...
You don't have
it. Don't you have the illustrated edition? Right there, isn't that illustrated, the illustrated edition? Face out? That's signed. Yeah. That's signed. It's a Tipton, but it's signed. Yeah. Yeah.
It was stuck together. The pages were stuck together.
I know those are signed. I signed the whole first print run of that book. 10,000 copies I had to sign. It took me 2 months.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, now she's going to cry, so I think we have to wrap things up. Yeah, I think tears are actually going to come out of her eyes in just a second.
Oh, that's so funny.
How cool was that, though, to, like, see her experience that for the very first time? Because that was awesome.
This is a treat. This was a treat copy, because you know the story about the original versions of the parasol first, now since replaced. And I thought, no, I'm going to treat myself to this illustrator because I've been wanting it for so long. And I just got it, and it sang.
It sang. Yeah, that's really fun.
Genuinely emotional about this.
There's a problem with a lot of the book distribution systems in that they don't allow you to trigger to tell the audience whether it's signed or not. Like Amazon doesn't have a flag for it, and like a lot of the other book depository and stuff, they don't have a flag for it. So like there are like editions that are signed of like whole print runs like that, but like the listing won't say that it's signed because there's no field for that as part of the back end metadata. So
that's amazing.
Weird insight into the book industry.
I might have to go back and tell her that later because she's blocked everything else out right now.
Sorry. I got technical fine. For a second.
It's fine. I'm totally for it. This is. I love looking at signatures and then looking through and going, yeah, it's definitely a real signature because it's indented.
Oh yeah, trust me.
Oh my god, you've touched this.
Yes, I physically touched that page. I did.
Just the problem is with the UK, we get authors over here. But where I live, they don't tend to come. Nobody likes the northeast of Britain.
Which city are you closest to?
Newcastle would be the big city. And you, when you were recently in Britain, I think you were in Edinburgh.
I was in Edinburgh, but I didn't do any signings.
And obviously, social media stalking. I was like, she's in Edinburgh. Can I just go and see if I can? And my husband's like, no, Claire, you have a child to look after. Stay home.
I've been to Nottingham. I've done Nottingham twice.
I love Nottingham.
I think I had a fan on staff there at the Walden Books or whatever it was called at the time.
Yeah, and you went in London as well. You did a signing.
Yeah, I did London. I've done London twice. Yeah,
and I was so tempted. I priced up the train tickets and the hotel tickets, and I couldn't afford to go down. It was a lot of money. And I did, and I would always look to see which authors were potentially going to be in London for me to then be able to take a book down and get signed.
That's a really good idea. That's a really good idea.
It never happened. So I do always try and keep my eyes open, but it's so infrequent because of obviously cost of travel for authors who are not British based to be able to get here, and it's just a pain. So I try and get signed copies where I can, like import through. But this is absolutely,
but you know,
I'm shaking. I'm so happy.
But you know, if an author has been to a store, they usually sign all of that store's stock. So you can also call the store either ahead of time and pre-order to get it signed for you, or you can check in just after they've left and be like, you know, did they sign stock? Because usually they make us sign, any store makes us sign stock. So they have signed editions, even if you can't get to meet the author in person.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try and do that a bit more now. It's just, it's crazy.
You're so cute. Oh,
sorry.
I really fully expect, like, when we hang up with you, it's just tears are going to come out, and she's just, like, sounds that no one can actually hear are going to come out. It's all going to happen.
Are we done? Should I leave that so that the
I'm sorry.
We're done. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the revelation.
You're so welcome. Bye, ladies.
Bye. Oh, that was the coolest thing ever. You're crying.
I'm dead now.
You're literally crying. I'm just going to go ahead and wrap it up. We don't even need to say any more words. So that's it for this bonus episode of Fictional Hangover. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire.
Join us next time as we discuss Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion. Contact us if you'd like to join us for an upcoming Would You Rather segment, or if you have any books to recommend. Look out for the next Would You Rather poll on social media. Don't forget about our book club and monthly challenges on Facebook. And be sure to visit our brand new shop on Redbubble at fictionalhangover.redbubble.com. Remember, no ER. Shop there to find all your favorite Fictional Hangover themed merchandise. Until next time, remember, the only cure for a fictional hangover is another book. Thank you.
find us at fictionalhangover.com. Follow us on Instagram at fictionalhangover. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionalhangover and on Twitter at fictionalhangover, no ER. If you'd like this episode, check out our others and rate, review and subscribe so you don't miss out. And finally, special thanks to Liz Emerson for our music. You can find her on Facebook and Patreon. Thanks for listening.